It is 12 p.m. noon here on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and it's July 28th, 2018, of course. I hope you're enjoying your Saturday. The 26th marked the anniversary of George H.W. Bush signing the Americans with Disability Act, which of course gave the rights to people with disabilities not to be discriminated against for things like such as employment. And I'm going to just play the speech that George H.W. Bush talking about that when he signed the Americans with Disability Act on July 26th, 1990, so that would have been Thursday that marked the anniversary of that.
Thank you all. Thank you all. Sandy, just great day. Evan, thank you so much, and welcome to every one of you out there in this splendid scene of hope spread across the south lawn of the White House. This is an immensely important day, a day that belongs to all of you. And everywhere I look, I see people who have dedicated themselves to making sure that this day would come to pass. My friends from Congress, as I say, who work so diligently with the best interest of all at heart, Democrats and Republicans, members of this administration, and I'm pleased to see so many top officials and members of my cabinet here today who brought their caring and expertise to this fight. And then the organizations, so many dedicated organizations for people with disabilities who gave their time and their strength, and perhaps most of all, everyone out there and others across the breadth of this nation, our 43 million Americans with disabilities. You have made this happen. All of you have made this happen. To all of you, I just want to say your triumph is that your bill will now be law and that this day belongs to you. And on behalf of our nation, thank you very, very much. Three weeks ago, we celebrated our nation's Independence Day. And today we're here to rejoice in and celebrate another Independence Day, one that is long overdue. And with today's signing of the landmark Americans for Disabilities Act, every man, woman, and child with a disability can now pass through once closed doors into a bright new era of equality, independence, and freedom. And as I look around at all these joyous faces, I remember clearly how many years of dedicated commitment have gone into making this historic new Civil Rights Act a reality? It's been the work of a true coalition, a strong and inspiring coalition of people who have shared both a dream and a passionate determination to make that dream come true. And it's been a coalition in the finest spirit, a joining of Democrats and Republicans, of the legislative and the executive branches, of federal and state agencies, of public officials and private citizens, of people with disabilities and without. This historic act is the world's first comprehensive declaration of equality for people with disabilities, the first. Its passage has made the United States the international leader on this human rights issue, and already leaders of several other countries, including Sweden, Japan, the Soviet Union, and all 12 members of the EEC have announced that they hope to enact now similar legislation. Our success with this act proves that we are keeping faith with the spirit of our courageous forefathers who wrote in the Declaration of Independence, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." And these words have been our guide for more than two centuries as we've labored to form our more perfect union. But tragically, for too many Americans, the blessings of liberty have been limited or even denied. And the Civil Rights Act of 64 took a bold step towards righting that wrong, but the stark fact remained that people with disabilities were still victims of segregation and discrimination, and this was intolerable. And today's legislation brings us closer to that day when no Americans will ever again be deprived of their basic guarantee of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This act is powerful in its simplicity. It will ensure that people with disabilities are given the basic guarantees for which they have worked so long and so hard. Independence, freedom of choice, control of their lives, the opportunity to blend fully and equally into the rich mosaic of the American mainstream. And legally, it will provide our disabled community with a powerful expansion of protections and then basic civil rights. It will guarantee fair and just access to the fruits of American life, which we all must be able to enjoy. And then specifically, first, the ADA ensures that employers covered by the Act cannot discriminate against qualified individuals with disabilities. The ADA ensures access to public accommodations such as restaurants, hotels, shopping centers, and offices. And third, the ADA ensures expanded access to transportation services. And fourth, the ADA ensures equivalent telephone services for people with speech or hearing impediments. And these provisions mean so much to so many. To one brave girl in particular, they will mean the world. Lisa Carl, a young Washington State woman with cerebral palsy, who I'm told is with us today, now will always be admitted to her hometown theater. Lisa, you might have been not have been welcome at your theater, but I'll tell you, welcome to the White House. We're glad you're here. The ADA is a dramatic renewal, not only for those with disabilities, but for all of us, because along with the precious privilege of being an American comes a sacred duty to ensure that every other American's rights are also guaranteed. And together, we must remove the physical barriers we have created and the social barriers that we've accepted. For ours will never be a truly prosperous nation until all within it prosper. And for inspiration, we need look no further than our own neighbors. With us in that wonderful crowd out there are people representing 18 of the daily points of light that I've named for their extraordinary involvement with the disabled community. We applaud you and your shining example, and thank you for your leadership for all that are here today.
The usual happens.
Now let me just tell you a wonderful story, a story about children already working in the spirit of the ADA, a story that really touched me. Across the nation, some 10,000 youngsters with disabilities are part of Little League's Challenger Division. And their teams play just like others, but, and this is the most remarkable part, as they play, at their sides are volunteer buddies from conventional Little League teams. And all of these players work together, and they team up to wheel around the bases and to field grounders together, and most of all just to play and become friends. We must let these children be our guides and inspiration. And I also want to say a special word to our friends in the business community. You have in your hands the key to the success of this act, for you can unlock a splendid resource of untapped human potential that, when freed, will enrich us all. I know there have been concerns that the ADA may be vague or costly or may lead endlessly to litigation, but I want to reassure you right now that my administration and the United States Congress have carefully crafted this act. We've all been determined to ensure that it gives flexibility, particularly in terms of the timetable of implementation, and we've been committed to containing the costs that may be incurred. This act does something important for American business, though, and remember this. You've called for new sources of workers. Well, many of our fellow citizens with disabilities are unemployed. They want to work, and they can work, and this is a tremendous pool of people. And remember, this is a tremendous pool of people who will bring to jobs diversity, loyalty, proven low turnover rate, and only one request, the chance to prove themselves. And when you add together federal, state, local, and private funds, it costs almost $200 billion annually to support Americans with disabilities, in effect, to keep them dependent. Well, when given the opportunity to be independent, they will move proudly into the economic mainstream of American life, and that's what this legislation is all about. Our problems are large, but our unified heart is larger. Our challenges are great, but our will is greater. And in our America, the most generous, optimistic nation on the face of the earth, we must not and will not rest until every man and woman with a dream has the means to achieve it. And today, America welcomes into the mainstream of life all of our fellow citizens with disabilities. We embrace you for your abilities and for your disabilities, for our similarities and indeed for our differences, for your past courage and your future dreams. And last year, we celebrated the victory of international freedom. Even the strongest person couldn't scale the Berlin Wall to gain the elusive promise of independence that lay just beyond. And so together, we rejoiced when that barrier fell. And now I sign legislation which takes a sledgehammer to another wall, one which has for too many generations separated Americans with disabilities from the freedom they could glimpse but not grasp. And once again, we rejoice as this barrier falls, proclaiming together, we will not accept, we will not excuse, we will not tolerate discrimination in America. Again, great thanks to the members of the United States Senate, leaders of whom are here today, and those who work so tirelessly for this legislation on both sides of the aisle, and to those members of the House of Representatives with us here today, Democrats and Republicans as well, I salute you. And on your behalf, as well as the behalf of this entire country, I now lift my pen to sign this Americans with Disability Act and say, let the shameful wall of exclusion finally come tumbling down. God bless you all.
And that was President George H.W. Bush signing the Americans with Disabilities Act on July 26, 1990. And that audio was thanks to U.S. National Archives YouTube for having that video audio available. July 25th now, so a few days ago, marked the anniversary of a speech that President John F. Kennedy spoke, gave on the Berlin crisis and announced about spending arms. And so this was essentially the whole Berlin Wall situation that was going on, of course, with the Cold War in the 60s. So this is John F. Kennedy talking, giving a speech about the Berlin situation.
7 weeks ago tonight, I returned from Europe to report on my meeting with Premier Khrushchev and the others. His grim warnings about the future of the world, his aide memoir on Berlin, the subsequent speeches and threats which he and his agents have launched, and the increase in the Soviet military budget that he has announced, have all prompted a series of decisions by the administration and a series of consultations with the members of the NATO organization. In Berlin, as you recall, he intends to bring to an end, through a stroke of the pen, first, our legal rights to be in West Berlin, and secondly, our ability to make good on our commitments to 2 million people of that city. That we cannot permit. We are clear about what must be done, and we intend to do it. I want to talk frankly with you tonight about the first steps that we shall take. These actions will require sacrifice on the part of many of our citizens. More will be required in the future. They will require from all of us courage and perseverance in the years to come. But if we and our allies act out of strength and unity of purpose, with calm determination and steady nerves, using restraint in our words as well as our weapons, I am hopeful that both peace and freedom will be sustained. The immediate threat to free men is in West Berlin, but that isolated outpost is not an isolated problem. The threat is worldwide. Our efforts must be equally wide and strong, and not be obsessed by any single manufactured crisis. We face a challenge in Berlin, but there is also a challenge in Southeast Asia, where the borders are less guarded, the enemy harder to find, and the dangers of communism less apparent to those who have so little. We face a challenge in our own hemisphere, and indeed wherever else the freedom of human beings is at stake. Let me remind you that the fortunes of war and diplomacy left the free people of West Berlin in 1945 110 miles behind the Iron Curtain. This map makes very clear the problems that we face. The white is West Germany. The east is the area controlled by East Germany, but a separate territory under the control of the Allied powers. Thus, our rights there are clear and deep-rooted. But in addition to those rights is our commitment to sustain and defend, if need be, the opportunity for more than 2 million people to determine their own future and choose their own way of life. Thus, our presence in West Berlin and our access thereto cannot be ended by any act of the Soviet government. The NATO shield was long ago extended to cover West Berlin, and we have given our word that an attack upon that city will be regarded as an attack upon us all. For West Berlin, lying exposed 110 miles inside East Germany, surrounded by Soviet troops and close to Soviet supply lines has many roles. It is more than a showcase of liberty, a symbol, an island of freedom in a communist sea. It is even more than a link with the free world, a beacon of hope behind the Iron Curtain, an escape hatch for refugees. West Berlin is all of that. But above all, it has now become, as never before, the great testing place of Western courage and will, a focal point where our solemn commitments, stretching back over the years since 1945, and Soviet ambitions now meet in basic confrontation. It would be a mistake for others to look upon Berlin because of its location as a tempting target. The United States is there. The United Kingdom and France are there. The pledge of NATO is there. And the people of Berlin are there. It is as secure in that sense as the rest of us, for we cannot separate its safety from our own. I hear it said that West Berlin is militarily untenable, and so was Bastogne, and so, in fact, was Stalingrad. Any dangerous spot is tenable if men, brave men, will make it so. We do not want to fight, but we have fought before, and others in earlier times have made the same dangerous mistake of assuming that the West was too selfish and too soft and too divided to resist invasions of freedom in other lands. Those who threaten to unleash the forces of war on a dispute over West Berlin should recall the words of the ancient philosopher, a man who causes fear cannot be free from fear. We cannot and will not permit the communists to drive us out of Berlin, either gradually or by force. For if the fulfillment of our pledge to that city, our pledge to that city is essential to the morale and security of West Germany, to the unity of the entire free world, Soviet strategy has long been aimed not merely at Berlin, but at dividing and neutralizing all of Europe, forcing us back on our own shores. We must meet our often stated pledge to the free peoples of West Berlin and maintain our rights and their safety, even
introducing IT,
in order to maintain the confidence of other free peoples in our word and our resolve. The strength of the alliance on which our security depends is dependent in turn on our willingness to meet our commitments to them. So long as the communists insist that they are preparing to end by themselves, unilaterally, our rights in West Berlin and our commitments to its people, we must be prepared to defend those rights and those commitments. We will at all times be ready to talk, if talk will help. But we must also be ready to resist with force, if force is used upon us. Either alone would fail. Together they can serve the cause of freedom and peace. The new preparations that we shall make to defend the peace are part of the long-term buildup in our strength, which has been underway since January. They are based on our needs to meet a worldwide threat, on a basis which stretches far beyond the present Berlin crisis. Our primary purpose is neither propaganda nor provocation, but preparation. A first need is to hasten progress towards the military goals which the North Atlantic allies have set for themselves. In Europe today, nothing less will suffice. We will put even greater resources into fulfilling
look
these
out,
goals.
Look out, bugs. Now.
And we look to our allies to do the same. The supplemental defense buildups that I asked from the Congress in March and May have already started moving us towards these and our other defense goals. They included an increase in the size of the Marine Corps, improved readiness of our reserves, expansion of our air and sea lift, and stepped up procurement of needed weapons, ammunition, and other items to ensure a continuing invulnerable capacity to deter or destroy any aggressor, they provided for the strengthening of our missile power and for putting 50% of our B-52s and B-47s, bombers, on a ground alert, which would send them on their way with 15 minutes warning. These measures must be speeded up, and still others must now be taken. We must have sea and air lift capable of moving our forces quickly and in large numbers to any part of the world. But even more importantly, we need the capability of placing in any critical area at the appropriate time a force which, combined with those of our allies, is large enough to make clear our determination and our ability to defend our rights at all costs and to meet all levels of aggressive pressure with whatever levels of force are required. We intend to have a wider choice than humiliation or all-out nuclear action. While it is unwise at this time either to call up or send abroad excessive number of these troops before they are needed, let me make it clear that I intend to take, as time goes on, whatever steps are necessary to make certain that such forces can be deployed at the appropriate time without lessening our ability to meet our commitments elsewhere. Thus, in the days and months ahead, I shall not hesitate to ask the Congress for additional measures or exercise any of the executive powers that I possess to meet this threat to peace. Everything essential to the security of freedom must be done. And if that should require more men or more taxes or more controls or other new powers, I shall not hesitate to ask them. The measures proposed today will be constantly studied and altered as necessary. But while we will not let panic shape our policy, neither will we permit timidity to direct our program, and accordingly I am now taking the following steps. I am tomorrow requesting the Congress for the current fiscal year an additional $3,247,000,000 of appropriations for the armed forces to fill out our present Army divisions and to make more men available for prompt deployment. I am requesting an increase in the Army's total authorized strength from 875,000 to approximately 1 million men. Three, I am requesting an increase of 29,000 and 63,000 men, respectively, in the active duty strength of the Navy and the Air Force. Four, to fulfill these manpower needs, I am ordering that our draft calls be doubled and tripled in the coming months. I am asking the Congress for authority to order to active duty certain ready reserve units and individual reservists and to extend tours of duty. And under that authority, I am planning to order to active duty a number of air transport squadrons and Air National Guard tactical air squadrons to give us the airlift capacity and protection that we need.
And again, that was a speech by John F. Kennedy on the Berlin crisis situation, and that was on July 25th, 1961, and that was from the Central Intelligence Agency's YouTube channel, so thank you to them for having that video available on YouTube and audio for me to use. Just some public service announcements before I continue. The art theaters, these are the art theaters listing for the this weekend. Sorry to Bother You will continue for another week with daily screenings. The storyline takes place in Oakland, California, where a telemarketer, Cassius Green, finds himself in a macabre universe after he discovers a magical key that leads him to to material glory. He soon falls under the spell of a cocaine-snorting CEO who offers him a salary beyond his wildest dreams. Also playing is Aquila and the Bee, which plays this weekend at 11:30 a.m. The film is about an 11-year-old girl living in South Los Angeles who discovers her talent for spelling. Aquila hopes her skills will take her to the National Spelling Bee. And also playing, Cemetery Without Crosses, which is a 1969 French take on the spaghetti western film genre. The movie concerns a leather-clad killer who is drawn into a kidnapping plot by a former flame or love interest. It plays this weekend at the late night 10 p.m. screening. So 10 p.m. is when that film is playing. Also, and finally, Deconstructing the Beatles, The Birth of the Beatles, will be playing on Tuesday, July 31st at 7:30 p.m. This is the second installment of Scott Freeman's lecture series, where he explores the path that brought four Liverpool teenagers to superstardom as the Beatles, from their early days as the Quarrymen to their transformation in Hamburg, and the many characters who helped them on their journey. And of course, for all up-to-date times, please feel free to go to the Art Theater's website, www.theartheater.org, or .org. And of course, as a reminder, just to let you know that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. And I just wanted to also get to a couple pretty big news stories that happened this week. Michael Cohen, who is the former personal attorney for President Donald Trump, claimed that Trump approved going ahead with a meeting that happened in 2016 at Trump Tower, in which Donald Trump Jr., President Trump's son, and other Trump campaign officials met with Russians to offer the Trump campaign dirt on Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, according to CNN. Michael Cohen's claims contradict denials by Donald Trump Jr. and Donald Trump, as well as their lawyers and administration officials, who said that then-candidate Donald Trump was unaware of the meeting until he was approached about it by the New York Times in July 2017. And Cohen said he was willing to testify with the Mueller investigation. So, again, this is one of those situations where we'll just have to wait and see as this investigation continues. And this was just 2 days, and this is a New York Times article that was published yesterday, just 2 days after the White House postponed plans to have President Vladimir Putin of Russia to visit Washington in the fall. The Russian leader said on Friday that he had invited President Trump to visit him in Moscow. President Vladimir Putin praised Trump as a leader who, quote, seeks to keep his promises. Mr. Putin continued to push for a second summit meeting, though the first this month was, of course, as you might have heard, generated with intense criticism of his American counterpart. Mr. Putin said he was ready to meet either in Washington or Moscow, adding that he had already told Mr. Trump he had an invitation to visit the Russian capital. And the White House quickly has responded, favorably to the idea. President Trump, quote, looks forward to having President Putin to Washington after the first of the year, and he is open to visiting Moscow upon receiving a formal invitation, according to White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, which she told to reporters. And today actually marks the anniversary of Richard Nixon being nominated for the Republican in 1960. Of course, he of course would go on to lose against John F. Kennedy in that election, but he would eventually win, become president in 1968. But since today is the anniversary of Richard Nixon being nominated, this is his convention acceptance speech that he gave at the Republican convention in Chicago in July 28th, 1916.
Mr. Chairman, Pat, for our daughters, for my mother, for all of us who are representing our party, is of course the greatest moment of my life. And I want you to... And I just want you to know that my only prayer as I stand here is that in the months ahead, I may be in some way worthy of the affection and the trust which you have presented to me on this occasion. In everything that I say, everything that I do, everything that I think in this campaign and afterwards. And may I say also that I have been wanting to come to this convention, but because of the protocol that makes it necessary for a candidate not to attend the convention until the nominations are over, I've had to look on it on television. But I want all of you to know that I have never been so proud of my party as I have been in these last 3 days. And as I have compared this convention, the conduct of our delegates and our speakers with what went on in my native state of California just 2 weeks ago. And I congratulate Chairman Halleck and Chairman Morton and all of those who have helped to make this convention one that will stand in the annals of our party forever as one of the finest we have ever held. Have you ever stopped to think of the memories you will take away from this convention? The things that run through my mind are these: that first day with the magnificent speeches, Mr. Hoover with his great lesson for the American people, Walter Judd with one of the most outstanding keynote addresses in either party in the history. And last night, our beloved fighting president making the greatest speech that I have ever heard him make before this convention. Your platform and its magnificent presentation by Chuck Percy, the chairman. For these and for so many other things, I want to congratulate you tonight and to thank you from the bottom of my heart and on behalf of Americans, not just Republicans, Americans everywhere, for making us proud of our country and of our two-party system for what you have done. And tonight, too, I particularly want to thank this convention for nominating as my running mate, a world statesman of the first rank, my friend and colleague, Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts. In refreshing contrast to what happened in Los Angeles, you nominated a man who shares my views on the great issues and who will work with me and not against me in carrying out our magnificent platform. And may I say that during this week, we Republicans who feel our convictions strongly about our party and about our country have had our differences. But as the speech by Senator Goldwater indicated yesterday, and the eloquent and gracious remarks of my friend Nelson Rockefeller indicated tonight, we Republicans know that the differences that divide us are infinitesimal compared to the gulf between us and what the Democrats would put upon us from what they did at Los Angeles at their convention 2 weeks ago. It was only 8 years ago that I stood in this very place after you had nominated as our candidate for the president one of the great men of our century. And I say to you tonight that for generations to come, Americans, regardless of party, will gratefully remember Dwight Eisenhower as the man who brought peace to America, as the man under whose leadership Americans enjoyed the greatest progress and prosperity in history. But above all, they will remember him as the man who restored honesty, integrity, and dignity to the conduct of government in the highest office of this land. And my fellow Americans, I know now that you will understand what I next say, because the next president of the United States will have his great example to follow, because the next president will have new and challenging problems in the world of utmost gravity. This truly is a time for greatness in America's leadership. I am sure you will understand why I do not say tonight that I alone am the man who can furnish that leadership. That question is not for me, but for you to decide. And I only ask that the thousands in this hall and the millions listening to me on television, I only ask that you make that decision in the most thoughtful way that you possibly can, because what you decide this November will not only affect your lives, and your future, it will affect the future of millions throughout the world. And I urge you, study the records of the candidates. Listen to my speeches and that of my opponent and that of Mr. Lodge and that of his opponent. And then after you have studied our records and listened to our speeches, decide. Decide on the basis of what we say and what we believe, which is best qualified to lead America and the free world in this critical period. And to help you make this decision, I would like to discuss tonight some of the great problems which will confront the next president of the United States and the policies I believe that should be adopted to meet them. 100 years ago in this city, Abraham Lincoln was nominated for president of the United States. The problems which will confront our next president will be even greater than those that confronted him. The question then was freedom for the slaves and survival of the nation. The question now is freedom for all mankind and the survival of civilization. And the choice you make, you, each of you listening to me, makes this November can affect the answer to that question. What should your choice be, and what is it? Well, let's first examine what our opponents offered in Los Angeles 2 weeks ago. They claimed theirs was a new program. But you know what it was? It was simply the same old proposition that a political party should be all things to all men, and nothing more than that. And they promised everything to everybody, with one exception. They didn't promise to pay the bill. And I say tonight that with their convention, their platform, and their ticket, they composed a symphony of political cynicism which is out of harmony with our times today. Now, we come to the key question, what should our answer be? And some might say, why do as they do? Outpromise them, because that's the only way to win. And I want to tell you my answer. I happen to believe that their program would be disastrous for America. It would wreck our economy. It would dash our people's high hopes for a better life. And I serve notice here and now that whatever the political consequences, we are not going to try to outpromise our opponents in this campaign. We are not going to make promises we cannot and should not keep, and we are not going to try to buy the people's votes with their own money. And to those who say that this position will mean political defeat, my answer is this: we have more faith than that in the good sense of the American people, provided the people know the facts. And that's where we come in. And I pledge to you tonight that we will bring the facts home to the American people. And we will do it with a campaign such as this country has never seen before. I have been asked by the newsmen sitting on my right and my left all week long, when is this campaign going to begin, Mr. Vice President? On the day after Labor Day or one of the other traditional starting dates? And this is my answer. This campaign begins tonight, here and now, and it goes on. And this campaign will continue from now until November 8th without any let-up. And I've also been asked by my friends in the press on either side here. They say, Mr. Vice President, where are you going to concentrate? What states are you going to visit? And this is my answer. In this campaign, we are going to take no states for granted, and we aren't going to concede any states to the opposition. And I announce to you tonight, and I pledge to you, that I personally will carry this campaign into every one of the 50 states of this nation between now and November the 8th. And in this campaign, I make a prediction. I say that just as in 1952 and 1956, millions of Democrats will join us, not because they are deserting their party, but because their party deserted them at Los Angeles 2 weeks ago. Now, I have suggested to you what our friends of the opposition offered to the American people. What do we offer? First, we are proud to offer the best 8-year record of any administration in the history of this country. But my fellow Americans, that isn't all, and that isn't enough, because we happen to believe that a record is not something to stand on, but something to build on. And building on the great record of this administration, we shall build a better America. We shall build an America in which we shall see the realization of the dreams of millions of people, not only in America, but throughout the world, for a fuller, freer, richer life than men have ever known in the history of mankind. Let me tell you something of the goals of this better America toward which we will strive. In this America, our older citizens shall not only have adequate protection against the hazards of ill health, but a greater opportunity to lead a useful and productive life by participating to the extent they are able in the nation's exciting work rather than sitting on the sidelines. And in this better America, young Americans shall not only have the best basic education in America, but every boy and girl of ability, regardless of his financial circumstances, shall have the opportunity to develop his intellectual capabilities to the full. Our wage earners, shall enjoy increasingly higher wages in honest dollars, with better protection against the hazards of unemployment and old age. And for those millions of Americans who are still denied equality of rights and opportunity, I say there shall be the greatest progress in human rights since the days of Lincoln 100 years ago. And America's farmers, to whose hard work and almost incredible efficiency we owe the fact that we are the best fed, best clothed people in the world, I say America's farmers must and will receive what they do not have today and what they deserve, a fair share of America's ever-increasing prosperity. And to accomplish these things, we will develop to the full the untapped natural resources, our water, our minerals, our power, with which we are so fortunate to be blessed in this rich land of ours. And we shall provide for our scientists the support they need for the research that will open exciting new highways into the future. New highways in which we shall have progress which we cannot even dream of today. And above all, in this decade of the 60s, this decade of decision and progress, we will witness the continued revitalization of America's moral and spiritual strength.
And again, that was Richard Nixon's Republican Convention acceptance speech. Sorry, I had to cut it a bit short as we get to the end of this hour of the world we live in. And just wanted to give thanks to the YouTuber channel Kansas Politics for having that video available for me to play. Just another announcement. We at WEFT were recently informed of an issue with our broadcast tower. To stay on the air, we are making plans to relocate our antenna and transmitter in the next few months. This will cost approximately $50,000, which is an unanticipated expense that approaches our annual budget. If you are interested in helping to keep this community treasure operational, you can do so in one of several different ways. You could join WEFT as an individual member at weft.org, weft.org. If you have a business, you could become an underwriter of WEFT programming. If you know of possible grants or other types of funding, you could share that information with us, or even become a partner with WEFT on your next fundraiser. WEFT can provide manpower and free promotion. And of course, for more information, you could send an email to station manager, that's one word, at weft.org. And as always, stay tuned to 90.1 FM. That will be the end for the world we live in. I'm going to play a tune from Duke Ellington from his album The Far East Suite Special Mix. And this song or tune is Mount Harissa. So that'll be it for the world we live in. Enjoy the rest of your Saturday. Thanks.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Green Yoga Spa. Green Yoga Spa brings relaxation to Champaign-Urbana. Green Yoga Spa offers massage, including personal, deep tissue, couples, and prenatal. They also offer Thai yoga therapy, personal yoga instruction, nutritional coaching, Reiki, reflexology, naturopathic services, and mobile spa services.
For more information, head to greenyogaspa.com or call 217-367-9642.